Welcome back to 10 Frames Per Second. Mary Virginia Swanson is an author, educator, and advisor to photographers. She spent her career helping artists find the strengths in their work, identify appreciative audiences, and present their work in an informed, professional manner. Mary Virginia, along with Darius D. Himes, published your photography book in 2011 and recently released the third edition. Welcome, Mary Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us. We may call you Swanee like your fans and students do.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I really appreciate
this. Are we allowed to call you Swanee? I don't want to just put it out there.
I know. That's why I checked.
Well, welcome to the podcast. As a big photo book collector, I was very looking forward to this interview. So
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
So in your 2011 version of the book, you said that photo books have never commanded greater interest than they do today. And amazing, you found that to be true for your new editions. How can this be? Do you think there will eventually come a time of satiation?
No, I think that we are on an explosion of bookmaking. There's no question about it. The first edition of the book in 2011, we included an interview with Eileen Gittens and also with Dan Milner, who were very involved in Blurb. Eileen was the founder, and Dan still continues today to be what they refer to as the Blurb evangelist. But in those days, that was a real difference for everybody, that you could do digital printing, you could send a file off somewhere. We didn't have a lot of choices of papers or bindings or anything, but it was a phenomenal point of access for people. And from that point, in 2014, our then publisher, Princeton Architectural Press, was running low on its stock and decided to do an update in 2014, where we continued to kind of expand the component of to be published versus to be self-published. And then this edition that came out a few months ago in 2023 with Radius Books is a giant update. I mean, it's really been virtually, in our writing, it was about 8 years, but 10 years on paper. And now the book that used to really be about being published, and if you didn't get the contract you wanted, then you would consider self-publishing. Today, considering self-publishing is many people's first step. And we have an explosion of small presses and amazing number of producers now, from Conveyor in our country to Wilco to all these different companies that will help you make the book, even if you don't want to do the hands-on part. So there's just so many different points of access. We go straight through to the limited edition and the artist-made book in this third edition of the book, which to me is a really critical growth point for everyone. And watching curatorial librarians and heads of art research libraries inside of art museums, the growth of special collections, even in our great public libraries, and then without question, the great academic special collections are really interested in what the artist's interpretation of subjects are versus the academic study of it. That point of contact is a great new audience for photo book makers, and something that has been really a big focus for all of us in the making of this book. And we've continued the format. And Molly, you said you had the first edition 2011. We set it up that Darius and I have kind of deep essays throughout the book. And you'll notice in all three of the editions that our voice comes through on a different color paper than those from the outside, our industry voices, as we call them. So we've grown that to include a much greater group of roundtable discussions on every different topic. So we'll have a large group of editors, a group of designers, a group of publishers. We have a roundtable this time on the growth of the photo book fairs and the photo book awards, the dummy prizes and things like that. So we're really more mindful now in this one, or increasingly, I should say, mindful of the independent self-publisher, how to learn about the materiality that will amplify, of course, or can amplify the impact of your story on the reader. It might be a sense of motion in the book form or the different types of papers and all. But we felt it was really important to underscore that even those of you that are self-publishing really need to understand all of those things how to get the book out. We have interviews with bookstore owners. We have a real range of things that will help everybody get their book to their audience, whether it's through a local bookstore like your fabulous store in Baltimore. And I bet I was saying earlier, I loved that interview that you did at the year end and learning about the amazing book buyer at your Baltimore Art Museum. But how does that happen? How do you approach people? What's the Susan K. Grant wrote a wonderful piece about bringing your artist-made book to the special collections and private collections community. And how do you research that? How do you write that cover letter for that audience that we may not know? What does that audience need in a colophon versus a traditional trade book that's going into public libraries? So there's so many different layers now.
Yeah.
That we felt that we had to go much broader in this edition. And I really think we nailed it. I really do.
What's the biggest mistake you've seen that you see photographers make when creating a photo book?
You know, Joe, I have to say, I feel like, in fact, this is one of my kind of mantras is don't rush to the monograph. I see people wanting that big, you know, aperture book that they may have grown up with right out of the gate, when in fact doing something smaller, even self-publishing, all those different steps that we know you benefit from and your project benefits from, well, it also benefits when it comes to the book form. So slowing down is key to me.
So people rushing to get published is what you see is kind of the biggest detriment, I guess, to getting it out there.
Yes. I think they, and very often, as you can imagine, they're spending a tremendous amount of money on that first book and realize later that the audience was either smaller or different, and that something else in a different form even would have been a better form of communication of the project's intention.
It's pretty funny that the question is so simple. How do you publish a photography book? But the answer is 227 pages. it's really deep. And you really do cover so much. I love the roundtable discussions. Mm-hmm. Those really gave me so much information, much more than I've had in the past. And your assertion that making a book all comes down to clarity and unity, you know, and that's the thing that you have to end up working with photographers to understand. Because I thought one of the interesting things you said or alluded to was that most photographers really, they want a book, but they don't know exactly what they want. They haven't really thought it through. And so your process that you go through with them really helps them figure out, which is really, I mean, if you don't know exactly what you want, you are not going to get it, right?
Right. And really that comes from, honestly, having books in your hands. You know, going to your public library, your local bookstore, having a gathering of friends that are photo book collectors. I mean, for myself in a fairly small town, Tucson, we don't really have a bookstore, but we have amazing book people in town, and we get together and share who came back from the LA Art Book Fair with what. What did someone find at Perry Photo? I mean, we share what we've seen as often.
Oh, that's so cool.
And it's so good.
Yeah. I guess, like, What's the attraction of the photo book now? I mean, everything's digital. You know, I teach high school. I had a student the other day. We have a school newspaper, and I brought in paper stock to pick the kind of paper stock, and I brought in an actual newspaper. One of my students is like, I can't believe someone would actually sit and hold something like this, and like was playing around with the newspaper. Like, who did this? Like, why would you sit and read this? What is the attraction of the physical photo book in a kind of a digital world?
You know, for me, Joe, I feel like that engagement of the viewer with the subject and the intention of the author is key. And while our book isn't really a how-to, it's a what's possible. Joe, in our book, it's really not meant to be a how-to, it's a what is possible. Mm-hmm. And that's where, for me, that engagement with the object, the actual book object, whether it's newsprint, which I love, and I love that we can now get the tabloid size from like Newspaper Club, and you can order one copy and test it out. It's a fantastic way to communicate and so much more affordable, all the way through to the exquisite printing that many people can still do with tritone and even conveyor now can do a digital version of Tritome. And having that chance to really look deeply at it, to move the pages through, to have some kind of engagement that that brings us into the subject more. I don't know if you all remember Hidden Islam. That book was one of the Perifoto Aperture Prize winners a few years back. And every single page opened up, like we saw the outside of the mosque, and then you literally folded it open. And you are walking through that door and going into that space. Right. Some people bring that element of time to their books by doing an accordion fold. Other people draw our attention to different elements by perhaps putting text on, as we did, different paper and different color, but also different size paper, or putting a sheet of vellum to, again, open us to the gently into what's behind it, with a little hint of it coming through. That the most exciting thing to me is when people can accomplish a sort of enhancement of the story, or an amplification of the book for the reader, rather than a just, you know, I mean, I love the fact that people can publish with MagCloud, with Blurb, with all kinds of things. But what I see is people trying to put a picture in each space that they can. It's a template, and you fill it with all these things. Right. Blank space can be an amazing point of information to us, give us a moment of pause.
They're not designers, right? I mean, you know, photographers are often not designers as well.
Yeah. But to your point, Joe, I feel like the power of the book form is really when all of the elements come together, the concept, the content, the materiality, the design, and the reader's experience. And I find so few people really being mindful of all of that, the full experience.
Well, you say most photographers of a certain age, I'm thinking my age, learned of photography and fell in love with photography through photography books. And that was that was definitely me. You know, Robert Frank, Diane Arbus, Emmett Gowan, those were turning points before I ever knew any other photographer, probably before I ever walked into a museum to see a grand show. I saw that work, and that was just such a turning point in my life. But the younger photographers, they're not necessarily, I mean, some of them are, but I'm just wondering, I'm curious about how you think the digital photo book is going to evolve. Do you think it's going to have the kind of appeal that, you know, that the tactileness of the, what I think of as real photo book?
I think it's going to bring us many, many, many things that we wouldn't have had otherwise. When I look at something like Sonia Thompson's book that she did, that Conveyor produced, that has 10 or more sizes of paper in it, types of paper, all digitally printed. We have masters now of digital printing that really, given the opportunity, can do some amazing, amazing things. So it also means that, I mean, some of my favorite books that I've bought directly from artists, they've printed at home on their home inkjet book or inkjet printer. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, I love asking artists that when I'm at the LA Art Book Fair, which is my favorite in this country, there's a huge zine room and a lot of small presses, but, and especially people who are making and selling their own books themselves, and asking them who handled the printing, did they do the design? And the more and more I'm hearing is, yeah, I did all of it. I took design classes while I was in photo school, and I learned to print on my home printer. And this book you're holding in your hand, I printed at home. And maybe they have a local bindery that can help them with the other part, or Sonia Thompson got one of those Wiro machines, so she did all the binding herself, whereas she had the digital printers do the paper and the sizes, and then she bound it. It's a revolution in what you can do on your own. And that's the most exciting thing to me about what digital can do for people. You know, perhaps one day they'll have a Steidl book of their own But in the meantime, you know, do runs of 250, 300 copies. Get the book out there. Get your name out there. I also really love that there are a number of digital printing houses that will produce small bound books for you. One of my favorite examples is Matt Eich, a photographer that I know we all appreciate. And his series of small books that he does serve as, I would imagine, primarily promotional tools, but then they're also available for sale on his website. So it's a happy medium and a great learning tool for people, not unlike newsprint. When we think about, when I think about Louis Pelu's concept newspapers, those were mind-blowing newspapers in their time. And to see how even classrooms have used them as posters throughout the rooms.
Yeah.
And we paste it throughout the venues. It's
really good.
There's so much can happen.
What I really loved about those was Louis' assertion that, hey, take this work and go ahead and re-edit it, you know,
right.
and like check out the pacing, check out, you know, what could happen with your concept about how these images should work. And so just making it sort of more tactile and somewhat playful and a learning. Louis very devoted to, I think, learning and, you know, teaching and mentoring. And I think that's really a wonderful aspect of his work.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved in his interview in your episode 89, how he talked about John G. Morris, showing John Morris his book dummy. And he immediately starting to resequence it, you know,
right.
having it unbound so people can you invite that playfulness from people and that insight. But I don't think enough people stop and make book dummies either. There's a beautiful double page spread in our book by a Japanese born artist, Miho Kajoki, and I have the great fortune of meeting her at Perry Photo this year, and she told me she had made 100 dummies for that book. 100. And that is really working to make sure your materiality is communicated and enhancing the
because those were all handmade. Is that
no? They're not handmade, but it was all printed on vellum, some type of vellum and different textures. You can't miss it. It's the first double page spread in the book. But we really tried in this edition. You guys can tell me if you think we succeeded, but we really tried to have the books in illustrating this book. Show that photo books don't have to look the same anymore. There are classics, but there are also there's a page that's all bindings that's unbound. There's a double page spread that shows lots of spiral bound. There's all different forms that the book can take, and that's part of what we wanted to encourage for everyone.
The bar gets higher when you're talking about the amazing acceleration and proliferation of photo books. And, you know, this is also now one of those examples. It's really beautiful. And I was really struck by how much history you were able to put into, put into the book and how important that is. As an editor, I found that lots of photographers don't know the history of their own genre that they're working in. And here you are addressing that in the book, that they want to make a book, but they don't know the history of books.
You know, Darius and I both studied with a British photo history person and magazine editor named Bill Jay. And so we had just that whole sort of picture post and on into the magnum type of photography brought to the book form. Pounded into us and with great joy. And he had an amazing library. And what happened for us was Darius went on to graduate school from Arizona State, where we studied with Bill. He went to graduate school in Santa Fe at St. John's. And his day job, as it were, was working at PhotoEye. And PhotoEye, of course, one of our oldest bookstores, if not the oldest photo bookstores in the country. Started in Austin and ended up in Santa Fe about 25 years ago, I think. And so I was doing a lot of teaching at that point about marketing and moving people's work to their audience. And for me in Santa Fe, when I teach Santa Fe workshops, it was key to go to Photo iBooks, because Darius and Melanie McWhorter, who worked there then as well, amazing powerhouse knowledge of photo books. And Darius and I both had that strong photo history background, so we really connected with the history in them. When Martin Parr and Jerry Badger's books, Volume 1, well, and before that, Andrew Roth's 101 books, and all in all, that our learning continued, as I hope everyone's does. But what happened was Rickson Reed, the owner of PhotoEye, asked Darius when he worked there if he would be interested in editing a magazine on photography books. And this was early 2000s into the mid 2000s. Darius immediately asked me if we wanted to collaborate together on a column. So we had a column that ran in what was called the PhotoEye book list, and we called it Publisher Photography Book.
So that was the first iteration.
That's right. That was the first iteration. And it was structured really very similarly to the book today, because it started with why do you want a book? What's the role of the book in your career? How do you, you know, what do you love about the books that you love? Do you love the materiality? Do you love the where the essays fall, or that's simply pictures and no page numbers? Whatever it is about your book, start to really think about that hard before you step into making your own book. And it went all the way through the case studies, just like we have in the book. It ran, the magazine had a 3-year life, which for us translated in 12 episodes, if you will, of our column. And at the end of 3 years, Rickson decided to take the magazine online, and we weren't interested in that. And at that time, Darius left PhotoEye to found Radius Books, along with three of his Santa Fe colleagues. And so he was off and running and learning to be a publisher. And we knew that the column, the 12 columns, really was the foundation for a book one day. And for us, what really changed and kind of made us sit up and go, I think it's time to do the first edition, was Blurb being founded and the self-publishing opportunities and realities for people to really make their own books. And secondly, we started to see, partly from the Andrew Roth book and from Martin and Jerry's book, that the collectible photo book was on the rise and becoming really revered, that you would have these certain books and build your library from the classics onward. So we decided that that was reason enough to put the proposal together. Radius was a very young company, and they were very much monographic oriented, the occasional exhibition catalog, but more about a body of work than about photography, which our book was really about. So it took it, our first two editions were with Princeton Architectural Press. But I think it's important to note that the designer of the first two was David Chicky at Radius, who designed the third edition. So I think part of why the third edition is so successful in terms of its design and functionality is that David knew the content, he knew the readers in a sense, because we continued that sort of successful pathway to knowledge through it, with our deep essays, with our amazing contributors, and then the roundtables, as you mentioned earlier, Molly. So when we got to this book, the third edition, It was, again, beyond to be published or self-published. It's really gaining a broad understanding of the small press, how you as an individual author will work in a small press, how much you still need to know about printing or paper printing and binding, how much you need to understand about the timeline of publishing. And for me, of course, how much you need to understand and may be responsible for the timeline of marketing that book. So that's where the workbook really came in for us. That is new in this edition. It falls out of the back. If you unpack your book and take the shrink wrapped off, note that there's something that will fall out of the back. It's yes. a It's a one signature version of it, which anyone can go to our website for our book and download the 32-page version. But being mindful again of the growth of the self-publishing movement, I really wanted photographers attempting to make a book to have a bit of a path to follow. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I interviewed photographers that had been published, and I asked them to show me their notebooks from their first book. And of course, many were like, no, you really don't want to see those. You really do have to. And so, yeah, I wanted to see them. Yeah. And without question, sitting with an artist, going through their first book's notebook, they're like, I should have thought of this earlier. Mm. I didn't realize this would be so important throughout the whole process. They had all these things that would have really structured. So we kind of kept making this dummy of the workbook, putting things in the right place. And then that whole group that I worked with looked at it and was like, yeah, this is it. You got it right. To really think hard, to slow down, to not just learn about the papers that you like, but actually test them and write your test results down. Think about who the audience is and where they gather. How are you going to get the book in their hands? If you're self-publishing, who's your team? Right. Who have you committed to doing which part of it for what rate, and when is it due to be delivered, and when do you owe them that money? So you're building a budget, right? You're not only building a timeline, but you're building a budget. So that's why, to me, the workbook is critical for people. Whether you're years away from making the book, just that whole first section of about, talk about the books that you love and really why you love them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I gathered a bunch of just sort of, you know, phrases that everyone that you've interviewed that really just made so much sense to me. I mean, you've made a book that is incredibly authoritative, has incredibly useful information for everybody. And, you know, we're going to have another explosion of photo books because of this, you realize.
No, I have to share with you, Molly, something I love learning is that when publishers are telling the photographers that are sending submissions in to stop and read this book.
Oh,
it's like
yeah.
The best compliment right. You can have. I really want to help, you know, Darius and I both really want to help people make better books. Mm-hmm. Not waste money, not waste time, get their story told in a really, really beautiful and impactful way.
But aren't a lot of publishers like, I'm going to pull back a little bit because we've had guests on the show in the past. Aren't a lot of publishers taking advantage of photographers though? Not a lot. I would say a few where the photographer has to come up with a $25,000 and the photographer has to do the marketing and the photographer has to do the PR just to get a name on a book. I mean, that's the part of the business that I don't think is really out there publicly, because I think people are afraid maybe they won't get published if they bring that out. You know what I mean?
I understand completely. And it's part of why we want people to learn what it takes to do it before they dive in to do it themselves. You know, we are in a time when paper is rising. The paper in our book has gone up since we printed it. So next printing, we're already looking at enhanced expenses in that. Shipping's gone up. Distribution is expensive in the sense that it takes part of your profit away. But if it gets the work into the hands that you wish, then it's essential. You have to weigh what that means to you. On the other hand, we have more opportunities to get books into the hands of people through small book fairs and people sharing a table with their friend and getting the work out, just like is happening right now at the Codex Fair in San Francisco. I think for myself, if the object that you have in your hands after working with a publisher has the best paper, has the best printing, has the binding that suits it, has all of the elements, and it costs you to contribute to that, to get what you want, I can understand that. The part that I don't understand, Joe, is when publishers tell you up front, not necessarily even having seen a dummy, that, yeah, we'll make your book and it'll be, you know, X thousands of dollars. often 30. Mm-hmm. And you don't, how can you give a number when you don't even have a sense of what the final output is meant to be, what the materiality will cost, what will come from that? What are you paying for? So the formulaic publishers really asking for an amount without really sitting down and going through the material and testing papers and all that does not make any sense to me. And I think a lot of those publishers just assume that you will do a Kickstarter and you'll, which is not simple. A lot of people think it's easy until you've done one. It is
your book.
Really difficult.
Kickstarter. It's your next book.
Some really good people though are still doing Kickstarters. Jean Pina is funding his book that way.
Eugene Richards.
Yes, you talked about Eugene in one of your I think at the year end one, episode 86, the photo books of the year. But let me point something out. Eugene published that himself. He knew what he wanted. And he had an audience that he could reach on Kickstarter. Right. And so I applaud that. He got the book he wanted. He was able to accomplish a Kickstarter because he has an audience that trusts him, that knows that it will be an impactful book, as all of his books have been. So it can be the perfect solution for people. It just depends on who you want to reach with that book. And please don't give your money to a publisher before you know what it's actually going to result in and when it will come and what rights they have going forward to that book, even though you raised the money. There's a lot of elements and, early on in the book, Joe, we go through traditional publishing and there's a section called like behind the editorial door to help people understand what that means. And that's where the contract section is the deepest. Right after that, it's like, okay, you have a short list of publishers, you've gone to the book show and these are the publishers that you want to be with. You pitch to them, you get your submission right. You know, it's another checklist thing in our workbooks, like who did you send the submission and what was included? And if you don't get the contract that you want or the ask is too high, then you know that it's time to think differently about it. Mm-hmm. And if you still feel that physicality can be accomplished, maybe you set out, you hire a team of people that know that part of things and off you go. I also think a lot of publishers today that have the same designer, there's the potential for it to start to look like a line that's very much the same. Mm. It doesn't always happen that way. I think when I think about St. Lucie and Mark Alice Durant and his designer, Gwyneth, do an amazing job. Every book is completely different, but some people have the same designer and it looks very much similar. So I encourage everybody to really look at the whole line. And that's one of the beauties of the book fairs. You can see everything and hold everything in your hand. And get a sense of whether you think that it's going to be a good match for you. And frankly, the company that you will keep with that publisher's line as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically every book is like a snowflake. The process is going to be different. But one thing you can count on is that it's going to cost you money, you know, and it's an investment in your own career and marketing and making sure that you can get into the hands of people who are making a difference in the publishing and exhibition and photo book shows and whatever. I mean, it's a wonderful tool, but, you know, don't waste your time making a book that you haven't really thought long and hard about.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people don't take the time to look at the potential of a good, strong university press being, in fact, your best publisher. I've watched a number of university presses take on projects that I know had been shopped to the art books world. Mm-hmm. And the art book world was going to do, 500 copies, 750 copies, and the artist would have to pay a lot. Whereas the university world, if your book has a subject, they may be actually a better publisher for you to get the work out to that subject. University presses also often publish more on the front end to not experience the frequency of cost update and increases in paper and shipping and all. So for many people, the university press world is really a strong match. So there's a fantastic essay in the book by Alan Thomas from University of Chicago Press. And he speaks about, you know, why the university press can be a good match for you. And it's worth all of you having a look at that. Again, if you have a strong subject, if the book is very much a monograph and it's very much about rather abstract work, that's not the right thing for university right. press. But if you have there's an audience that they have already wrangled, that's fine. You know, it's similar to people presenting work to a gallery, because they go to the gallery because the gallery has work like theirs. Mm-hmm. Well, in the gallery world, they don't want to have too many people that are works like theirs. But in mm-hmm. the university press world, they're building a sort of volume of people that are interested in that topic. So that mm-hmm. is the opposite situation. They may very well welcome more voices yep. on that topic.
For all the universities in Baltimore, we don't have much of a culture like that, right?
So. You know, we have Johns Hopkins. I don't know what kind of books they publish.
They're hard to get to as far as photography. I mean, that's like a unicorn. Good luck finding a Hopkins good photo book, you know?
Yeah. I was wondering about that.
There are a couple of local photographers who have books, who have the book now, that were turned down by Hopkins. It would have been a completely acceptable university press photo book.
I think the place to start when considering university press is to look and see if they have done richly illustrated books in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's someone at the helm that makes sure that the publishing, like in the day, University of Texas, UT Press, was amazing.
Because they did amazing books. They're not doing it anymore.
Amazing books. Their art director rose to be the director of the press, and everything was just rocking at that point, but he has since left and things changed. One of the reasons that I think University of Chicago Press does so well for our world of photography people is that Alan Thomas, who's the executive editor, is also a picture maker himself, and he's the one that sort of shepherds those projects through. It's, you need that person that will keep the integrity of the body of work, the printing quality high, and things like that. But we're also starting to see the university press world need some subvention if you want that masterful paper and printing combination.
Can you give us an example of a university press book that you really thought was super successful and managed to find, you know, the right place with the right topic? And
you know, I will say University of Georgia and University of North Carolina have done beautiful books about the South and about Southern culture. And of course, want to see more proposals along that line. That's part of their mission. Right. So I've seen that both of them do books that have some critical text alongside the photo essay. And then the same with University of Chicago Press and with Alan's stewardship of photo books. I think the first book I saw that he had done that caught my eye was Ashley Gilbertson's Bedrooms of the Fallen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That was such a powerful book.
Such a powerful book. And then he went back to University of Chicago Press for a second book. And I remember asking him, you know, I said, Ash, did you go back to University of Chicago Press because contractually you were bound to bring them your next book? Or because you wanted, he said, I absolutely wanted to go back and work with Alan again. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the situation. I see UC Berkeley doing, out of University of California, doing some great photo books, but they tend to do more critical and historical anthologies and all. Several of Kate Albert's books through them have been outstanding. But they're not primarily pictures, they're primarily text. So that's a clue. I mean, and this is, you know, what we're speaking about with the university press versus traditional art book is part of the homework, honestly.
Yeah.
Absolutely part of the homework that everyone needs to do.
Research.
Exactly. And that's one of the kind of prompts for us in the workbook is like, why this publisher, why this printer, why this paper, all of those kinds of things to get the match right. You know, I will say this, very often a publisher, especially a university press that has such a broad audience appeal, they can help you find the right authors. They may have someone that they have published in-house already that would be a great person to write an essay about the sciences or about social justice or about the environment or something like that. So if your publisher can help you kind of build the book,
right,
that's a great thing. It happens as well at our publisher Radius, of course, because they're connected with extraordinary curators and critics and writers, and many times can bring those things to the table as well. I have to say, working with a nonprofit publisher, the mission is solid. It's set. It's about education. It's about reaching audiences. And one of the appeals for us about Radius's model is they have a library donation program. It's a critical part of their mission. And so there are people that donate just to the library donation program to keep that spirit of sharing books alive. So, you know, we all make choices in who we align with. And in every part of our life, of course. But I think that there's lots of different models. You know, Michelle Dunn-Marsh has developed a very interesting model at Life Matters, where you pre-sell the books before you go to print. And we are in an interesting time of opportunity in publishing. So the full gamut from self-publishing to small presses and onward is really critical. You know, I do want to mention that one of the things that's new in this edition is really talking seriously about the limited edition and the artist-made book and who that audience is, who those collectors are. There's a roundtable of artists working in that arena that I think is interesting for everyone to learn from. And I understand that the hands-on is not necessarily for everyone, but the limited edition is something that's accomplishable as well. I want to also point out that one of the things I've learned from talking to curatorial librarians at public libraries, academics, in the art research libraries within curators, working with the curatorial print collections alongside, that the making of the book and the creative practice involved in the making of the book is really of great interest to many of those people. So from the maquette on, you'll see the voice of John Evans in the roundtable of collectors. And he is the head of the libraries and archives at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. And there's a clip on our website of John speaking with the artist Alejandro Cartagena from Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
How he began watching Alejandro's work and his whole process of the maquettes all the way through to multiple types of printing to make sure it was right. And just that his creative practice around the book is critical. There's another clip of Alejandro talking in our La Luz class, Molly, which you've been a part of in the past. Mm-hmm. Alejandro talks about his aha moment when he, as he referred to it, he sacrificed the project for the book instead of the wall. So I think it's something that we don't talk enough about. And Dianita Singh, who's one of our case studies, for her, it's really her mission to say that for her, the book is the final work. It's mm-hmm. not the prints on the wall. It's the object that you bring the story together in. And for someone like Dianita, she feels very strongly that to add a print at the back as a collector's edition devalues the book.
Interesting.
And I know a number of special collections curators in academic libraries that if they feel like the book that's offered to them was in fact simply a catalog of an exhibition from the wall, in other words, that the work was made for the wall and not for the book form, they're not interested in it.
Right.
So it's something to really think hard about. It's a different group of collectors that will buy the book with the print than will see it perhaps in an academic collection.
Yeah, I mean, each iteration should be considered on its own value, right? Yes. I mean, it's not going to just transfer seamlessly to another medium, essentially, right?
Or market.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Lisa McCarty is one of the voices in the limited edition roundtable of artists. And when you look at Lisa's website, you can see that her book, Transcendental Concord, about the Transcendentalists, of course, in Concord, Mass., there's the trade edition, there's the limited edition, there's a special edition, and there's the library edition.
Oh, wow.
I had never seen before. And she created an object where the trade book, this was a Radius book, fits essentially in the well of a portfolio box. If you imagine there's a space that drops down and the book fits nice and snug in that. And then the walls of that portfolio box are tall enough to hold, I think it's 18 prints. So wow. That goes to collections who then have an exhibition in a box,
right,
as well as the book for research alongside it.
And you, and that's really a growing aspect of what's happening in the book world.
Yeah, I mean, the more we learn about special collections, and you know, and I'm referring to public libraries, academic libraries, curatorial art research libraries, and private collectors. Depends on if they want to see the work in depth as a point of discussion, as a wall exhibition, as well as have the book in hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lisa does show the prints in exhibition, but she always has a reading room of the work of the Transcendentalists as well in it. So depends on how you choose to combine the two, but it's been fascinating to get to know that group of people and what they bring to their libraries for their audiences. So for example, Deborah Hollis at the University of Colorado Boulder shared with us that the teachers in the sciences, and I mean everything from the social sciences to the health sciences to the environmental science and on, that sciences bring their students every semester to see the new books that they've acquired because they're fascinated by the way artists interpret the subjects they're studying, mm-hmm, rather than the more academic and classical path of study. So it shakes up the students and think a different way. And she shared with us that she even has departments on campus that say to her, if there's a work that you want to acquire and it's not in your budget to do that, let us know. We can help. And oftentimes alumni help in acquiring those. To me, that's a different level of legacy for your work.
Yeah.
That is acquired by someone who will care for it for the life of the materials and share it so broadly with everything from their audience to the public. So it's an exciting new audience to me for all of your projects.
You've really illuminated how it's continuing to grow, deepen, broaden, and it's so interesting. And it's a field that's sort of like, oh, you feel like you know something about it, but you probably, at least in my case, I've just dipped the surface. John wanted us to mention that Apprentice House Press at Loyola is the oldest student-run press in the United States and does 40-plus books per year. But we don't know how much photo books are a part of that collection, but we're going to have to check that out.
Definitely. I mean, there's probably opportunity for everyone there. What a great learning experience for the students involved and a perfect place for people to try different things and try different dummies. And really, I just encourage everybody to slow down, and working right there on campus is a great way to experiment.
Thank you so much, Swanee. I really enjoyed this conversation. We have to end it here, but okay. Maybe Joe can get his next book published by Apprentice House Press at Loyola. That'd be a really cool outcome from this show. So, yeah. I was going to ask you, I see you at book fairs, I see you doing classes, I see you publishing books. Like, what do you do for fun?
Oh my gosh, go to book fairs.
So that's the fun.
I mean, it is really, I love teaching and helping people to make better books. That is really important to me. And that's part of why we made the website free to everyone that wants to go and download that workbook. And download the lists of book producers, book fairs, book competitions, the independent bookstores that might carry their book, everything. And that's the legacy of this book to me, is to try to get everyone involved in learning. And we'll put that in the I'll give you all that information in link form so people can go to publisherphotographybook.com.
It's the same. Yes, absolutely. We plan to have lots of links available for students and people who want to publish books.
That's so great. Well, I hope to see all of you at some of our upcoming events, and please take advantage of not just the book, but everything that the website has to offer. It's been a great pleasure to have a chance to tell you more about it.
Thanks for all you do, Swanee.
Thank you, Molly.
We do appreciate it. See you soon.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye.